Hi, this is Irene Friedman, and the program is...
It's all about animals!
Yes, it is, and here's what's coming up today. We have some really great jokes, at least mine are pretty funny. I don't know about Mark's. And then I'm going to finish ginger pie. We've come to the end of the pie.
Oh, I love pie. You know what kind of pie I like, but...
Ginger pie.
Yes, yes.
Next week we'll be starting a new book, and then I have some articles from Catster Magazine and from Modern Dog Magazine. So let's get started with the jokes, and you're the guest, so you get to go first.
Well, Irene, you know, this week, let me tell you this. This is coffee month, or coffee day, actually.
Okay.
I think it's like the 29th, National Coffee Day. And I've got some coffee jokes for you just for that day.
Okay, so we're not doing animal jokes, at least you're not.
You never know. You might get an animal in here every once in a while.
Well, I'll jab a crack at them.
Ooh, okay. Okay, so why is a bad cup of coffee the end of a marriage? Why is a bad cup of coffee the end of a marriage?
Because they're grounds for divorce?
Yeah.
Is that correct?
You got it.
Okay, boy. Okay. that was a good one. Okay.
You're quite the coffee drinker, so you probably heard every one of these.
I've never heard any coffee jokes.
Oh, well, stand by.
Okay. What should you do when you're serving a camel tea?
What should I do when I'm serving camel
do
tea?
Do or say, yeah.
Well, if I were a camel, what I would want you to say is, you know, I've got those big things on top, you know? You know what I'm talking about.
Yes.
And if I were a coffee, and maybe you're in a coffee shop, and I walk in, because I'm a camel, and instead of going, hey, Mike, what day is it? I might say, I'd like this cup of coffee. Then you'd probably say, well, do you want one hump or two?
And that's correct. Ask him if he'd like one hump or two. I didn't think you would get that. Okay, next joke from you.
Okay, what is the Beatles' best song, thinking that this is coffee day coming up? What is the Beatles' best song?
Oh, my gosh. There have to be a couple hundred of them.
Oh, there are a lot of them, Irene. But for this day, when it comes up.
Day.
Yes, yes. What is the best Beatles song?
Can't you give me a hint?
Oh, it's one that you love, Irene.
I love all the Beatles songs.
What is the best? Okay, you're at your house and you're at your table and maybe you have a neighbor over, you're on a stool and you're having a cup of coffee and all of a sudden this Beatles song comes on. You know it's the best.
Please me?
Oh no, but that's I guess it depends on who's there, Irene.
Let's see. And this has to do with coffee.
Yes, yes.
Paperback Writer. There are just so many Beatles songs and I love them all. Is this early Beatles or late Beatles?
Oh, maybe intermediate. Maybe middle of the road there. Maybe towards the end, I guess. Yeah, it's towards the end. It's past Revolver. Is it before or after the White Album? That's amazing. I don't know.
I'm just going as blank as can be.
Okay, well, you look blank there, Irene, so let me tell you. What is the best Beatles song? Latte B, Latte B.
Oh, come on. Now, who would have... I don't know who could have gotten that. Okay.
Well, I've got some lyrics probably for it, but, but that's all right.
Latte
we don't have time for that. Yes.
Yeah. Okay. Why is a sofa like a roasted turkey?
Why is a sofa like a basted turkey?
Roasted.
Oh, roasted turkey.
Roasted, not basted.
Not
roasted.
Basted. Why is a sofa like a basted?
Roasted.
Why is a sofa like a roasted turkey? Why is that? Boy, oh boy, oh boy. Why is a sofa like a roasted turkey? because, well, on the sofa, you kind of sit there on it, and you're kind of, sometimes you eat on it, sometimes you just watch TV, sometimes you converse with that special person that's over, Irene, but I don't think I have an answer for that.
Oh, you're going to moan and groan when you hear this. Why is a sofa like a roasted turkey? Because they're both filled with stuffing.
That was pretty good,
well,
Irene.
I'm glad you like that.
Okay, Well, I can't do that one probably, Irene, because you'd probably know that one. What do you call sad coffee? What do you call sad coffee? I figured you'd probably get this
sad
anyway.
Sad coffee. Is it a brand?
Nope. What do you call sad coffee, Irene? It's not black coffee.
Espresso?
You're close, Irene. Really? Oh, yes. You got the...
Sad espresso? You have a sad espresso on your face? I think you're pulling my leg when you tell me I'm close.
Nope, you're close, Irene, but you just have to get that right syllable in there, I guess.
Depresso? Is that it?
That's it, Irene.
Is that it? Depresso? Well, that's kind of stupid, you know?
Well, you know, it'd be a sad coffee because it was depressed.
Okay. Well, okay. Okay, I'm sure you remember childhood games.
I don't know about that. Yeah, sometimes, some of them.
What is a shark's favorite game?
What is a shark's favorite game? Well, you know, they have those fins that kind of stick up there, and you can kind of see them out of the water and stuff. So, I guess if I were a shark and I had a favorite game, I would be in the ocean.
Okay.
And I'd probably have other sharks around because I'd probably want to play this game with, you know, you don't want to play cards with sharks.
No, because they're card sharks.
Yes. But
is it card shark or card sharp?
Card shark, I think, yes. So, you know, I wouldn't want to play cards with my friendly, friends that are sharks. But I might play something like, and it depends on who was there, I might play Finn the Bottle.
Oh, that's good. I like your answer better than the books.
Well, I guess I've shot my wad. Go ahead and what's the answer?
Well, the answer in the book, but I like yours better, which I'm going to write in. What is a shark's favorite game? Swallow the leader.
I think I'd like to play that one.
Well, you know what?
We've
had three rounds of jokes, and we've come to the end of the joke segment.
Bye-bye, Irene.
Thank you so much for joining us. You've added a lot to today's program. And now we're going to continue with the last chapter in Ginger Pie. And Wally Bullwinkle and his father, they're on their way to New York, and the kids were so worried that Ginger was headed to the vaudeville show in New York, but it turns out he had been tied up all the time, and he's been found, and Uncle Benny is taking the credit for finding him, and Ginger is very, very happy to be home, and the kids didn't recognize him because he was a puppy when he got lost around Thanksgiving. Now he's a grown dog. So, backtracking one paragraph from last week, he was the smartest dog any of them had ever seen or read about anywhere to do such a thing as that. He had been a smart puppy, and now he was a smart dog. Sam Duty snapped a couple of pictures of Ginger crossing the tar with Gracie, but since the dog and the cat were moving so fast, he didn't expect the pictures would amount to much. Ginger just picked up life right where it had left off for him back on Thanksgiving Day. It almost seemed as though there should be the smell of roast chicken in the air and drumsticks to pick on. Ginger scratched Gracie's fleas, dashed for the orange duster, and brought Jerry rocks to throw for him. It turned out that while Ginger had been gone, he learned a great number. of new tricks which Jerry and Rachel and Uncle Benny learned about gradually. For instance, he could stand on his front paws, and he could also turn a somersault. "You don't have to do any tricks," said Jerry, hugging him, "just so you're back. That's all I care. You don't ever have to do one more trick." He could not bear to think that perhaps the terrible scar on Ginger's forehead was caused by a blow given him when he was being taught a new trick Wally and his father expected to use in vaudeville or the circus. Ginger's eyes had always been beautiful, gay, sparkling, laughing, and intelligent. Now they were even more beautiful, for there were sadness and pleading and anxious questioning in them, too. It was all any of them could do not to cry when they looked into Ginger's eyes, and each one vied with the others, saying endearing words to him and petting him to make up for all the sadness he had suffered shut up in that miserable Bullwinkle shed while all along they had been comfortable in their nice warm house. To think he had never been allowed out of Wally's little yard even for a good brisk run. Naturally, since he was a stolen dog, Wally had had to keep him under lock and key. Oh, Ginger, sobbed Rachel every now and then, kissing his wounded, hurting head. All the times we were right down there calling him and looking for him, said Jerry. Big dog, keep out, said Rachel indignantly. Wally was probably holding his fist over Ginger's mouth every time he saw us coming. Ginger probably heard us and knew we were right there, said Jerry. Well, comforted Mrs. Pye, that helped him to remember you and keep you in mind until the right moment came for his escape. Anyway, sad as Ginger's life had been while he was away, he was, from now on, the happiest dog in Cranberry. And Jerry and Rachel and Uncle Benny were the happiest children since he was back. They did love him so. It got to be noontime. The children all had some dinner, and then they had ice cream. Ginger had some, too, but the children didn't even realize they were eating ice cream. They were so excited. There had been lumps of frozen peach in it, as had Grandma's, so they might have known, but there weren't lumps. This was bought ice cream, though not steamboats, pickaxes, or robins. Sam Duty had some ice cream, too, and so did the chief of police. He came by just then, having had his buns and coffee at last, to make a report on latest developments. When the Pies could finally persuade Ginger to stop barking at him, Chief Larimer said, "I telephoned down the line when I got home, and I ordered the Banker's Express stopped and searched in Westport. Your dog is not on it," he said. Chief Larimer was not yet aware that the dog who had been barking at him was the long-missing famous Ginger. When he was told this and that the quest was ended, he looked a shade disappointed. It was obvious that he had other plans, such as ordering all dogs and shows examined carefully to see if they might be Ginger. However, Jerry and Rachel looked at him so admiringly, he had, after all, thought of marvelous ways of tracing their dog, having the Banker's Express itself stopped, for example, that the chief's ruffled spirits were smooth. Nevertheless, in case the chief might feel was a reflection on his office that Ginger had not been found by him, but had been found by Uncle Benny, a 3-year-old, one of Cranberry's youngest citizens, he said, "The youngins threw me off the track with that picture they drew of the man. We thought Wally Bullwinkle was just a boy in my class," explained Jerry apologetically, for now it seemed as though from the beginning, it should have been as plain as the nose on his face that Wally had been the thief. "We didn't know Wally was a thief, and he didn't look like the picture we drew of the unsavory character. We didn't know an unsavory character could be just the boy in my class," said Jerry. "Wally hasn't any mother, said Rachel. "She didn't want Wally to go to jail. She wanted someone to be nice to him and make him nice. His father probably didn't know he had stolen Ginger," she said, making excuses for Mr. Bullwinkle also. "That may well be," said Chief Larimer, "but if you have any more thefts," he said, "don't draw me the thief." And he tramped off up the street, having to get to the bank before it closed. The next who came by were Mr. Badger and Dick Badger and Duke. They had been out in Cheshire and missed all the excitement. Mr. Badger wanted some pictures for the Cranberry Chronicle, and Sam Duty took them. One picture he took he called a happy reunion. It showed all the family gathered around Ginger while Ginger scratched the fleas of Gracie the cat. Another picture he took of just Uncle Benny and Ginger. Sam Duty named Uncle Benny the hero of the day. Uncle Benny had been a hero before just for being an uncle at the age of 3. Now he was a hero also for being the one to find Ginger. For it was Uncle Benny, after all, who insisted that Ginger was Ginger and had persuaded Grandma to let him follow them to the Pies. "I knew it was Ginger," he affirmed importantly. The picture that Sam Duty took of Uncle Benny and Ginger would win the $15 prize. That was what Jerry and Rachel thought, not the pictures of East Rock at all, not even the GNU one, which turned out to be a beauty. Uncle Benny, Uncle Benny, Uncle Benny, they all exclaimed affectionately. Uncle Benny, hero. Uncle Benny beamed. How the day passed, no one knew, but at last the great birthday day, the sort of a holiday, the day of Ginger Pie's dramatic return, came to an end. Everyone had gone, all the guests, the interested neighbors, Uncle Benny and Grandma. And it was night, that first night that Ginger was home and curled up sleeping on Jerry's feet as he used to, and there was in the distance the wonderful occasional sound of the trains running from New York to Boston, from Boston to New York, and Jerry said at first, he said comfortably, hoping she was not asleep, "Rachel, said Rachel, squirming delightedly. She knew what was coming. "Oh, Boombernickel," said Jerry. "Oh, Martin Boombernickel's." Rachel laughed softly. "Yes," she said. "And then what happened?" Just as though they had never stopped. Ginger twitched his ears and the loose skin on his back and legs to let Jerry know he was here and he was happy. Then he lowered his head down on his paws again, and he let out a deep sigh that sounded almost like a sob. There was in it so much relief and pain and pleasure and remembering. And that's the end of Ginger Pie. Here's a word about the author, Eleanor Estes. Born in 1906 and passed away in 1988, she grew up in West Haven, Connecticut, which she renamed Cranberry for her classic stories about the Moffat and Pye families. A children's librarian for many years, she launched her writing career with the publication of The Moffats in 1941. Two of her outstanding books about the Moffats, Rufus M. and The Middle Moffat, were awarded Newbery honors, as was her short novel, The Hundred Dresses. She won the Newbery Medal for Ginger Pie in 1952. The inspiration for Ginger Pie, the intellectual dog, came from a real dog who appeared pencil mouth in the window of the ivy-covered school of Eleanor Estes's childhood. So with that, we put away Ginger Pie, and we'll have a new book next week. Okay, moving on to Catster Magazine. This article is by Steve Dale, and it's called "Haters Gonna Hate. Why Do Some Humans Have Such a Dislike for the Elegant and Charming Feline?" In the mid-1300s, the Black Death was responsible for up to about 25 million deaths in Europe. Many people, including political and religious officials of the day, blamed cats for the plague. As a result, cats were annihilated. This turned out to be a costly mistake. Medical officials finally figured it out. The plague was transmitted to humans from Oriental rat fleas that live on black rats. Unfortunately, that's how it's been for cats through the ages, as the great world philosopher, cat lover, and pop and country music artist Taylor Swift has said, "'Cause the player's gonna play, 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 and the hater's gonna hate, 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 hate." The players of the day finally embraced the cats who killed the rats, and the deaths, as a result of the plague, of course, quickly declined. However, the cat haters continued assailing cats. Why? Why do dogs get the love? Ethologically speaking, we're closer to dogs. We co-evolved with that more slobbery species. Cro-Magnon men and women blossomed when relatives of today's wolves began the domestication process into dogs. Perhaps they're still hardwired to like dogs. While some cultures on the planet consider dogs dirty in the United States and the Western world, most people say they like dogs even if they don't have one. Exceptions to that are people who are allergic or who've had bad experiences. Cats came along much later. Unlike dogs, who we domesticated, cats pretty much domesticated themselves. Of course, they lived with us on their own terms. Cats took advantage of our grains that attracted vermin dinner, and thus over time, people and cats realized the benefits. Cats plus humans equal strong feelings. Today's domestic cat has experienced about 5,000 to 8,000 years of living with humans, a relative blip in evolutionary history, and far less than going back circa 40,000 years when dogs lived side by side with Cro-Magnon humans. If you're over 60 years old, you remember when most cats in the United States lived both indoors and outdoors, a very different lifestyle than the vast majority of today's cats. Unlike dogs, which for some can do no wrong, cats sometimes can't win. And most humans don't feel ambivalent about cats. They either love them so much that they can barely only have one or they scorn them. It's amazing how the human brain works. People who hate mustard, for example, and really just can't tolerate the taste also typically can't tolerate the smell. And sometimes even a TV commercial for mustard causes an aversive response. Cats are like mustard. For example, people with extreme allergies learn to dislike them so much that even TV commercials with cats may make them uncomfortable. Their disgust is unreasonable to cat lovers, but is cemented into the amygdala in their brains, and it's real. Cats get a bad rap. However, some people just don't like cats, and their dislike may be based on misinformation. Spread rumors about dogs, and they have little traction. Unsubstantiated reports about cats are another story, and to Taylor Swift's point, cat haters just gonna hate and fan the flames. With the advent of social media, it's become an inferno, but without substantiation. Here are two examples. Community cats wiping out birds. Some reports from bird conservation groups have suggested outdoor cats responsible for the destruction of 3.7 billion birds in the United States. According to data from Ann Beal's book, Community Cats, A Journey into the World of Feral Cats, 32% of what outdoor cats kill are birds, but most cats don't kill birds, or at least not very often. Community cats have been around for a long time, and in the United States there may actually be fewer community cats. Scientists not involved on either side of the argument agree that habitat destruction, light and air pollution, and climate change are the biggest ones to blame, and the issue is global because many songbird species migrate. Toxoplasmosis. Reports of schizophrenia occurring in adults, and particularly in children, as a result of cats carrying toxoplasmosis, keep popping up. Sadly, some consider these reports credible, despite the lack of documentation in a peer-reviewed journal, or even careful reading. For example, one study noted children with schizophrenia are more likely to have cats, but even the study's researchers conceded they were not in any way suggesting a link to cause-effect. The real truth is that a specific series of events must occur in order for any person to contact toxo from a kitty. The cat must be infected in the first place, and most cats in the United States are not infected with the organism, especially as most U.S. cats live indoors, 71% in 2016, according to the 2017-18 American Pet Products Association's Pet Owners Survey. Cats can only pass the disease 7 to 14 days their entire lives when there's an acute infection and the organism is in what is called the oocyst stage. If the cat is shedding the organism one of those 7 to 14 days, all you need to do is to scoop daily because it takes at least a day and typically several days for the virus to become infectious to people. Now, if this does happen to someone who is pregnant, it's very true that an infected unborn baby can suffer severe harm during the first trimester of pregnancy. Of course, avoiding this even remote possibility makes sense, but this is as simple as scooping promptly with gloves and hand washing or having another household member scoop. And then in parentheses, it says, see the Center for Disease Control and Prevention's frequently asked questions on toxoplasmosis at cdc.gov/parasite/toxoplasmosis. Fear of what's different. Part of the problem is that we understand and therefore trust dogs. Maybe we're born that way, as another philosopher and music artist Lady Gaga suggests. Cats are less understood and we don't like all their habits, like these darn hairballs, or their fondness for cozying up to the one person at the party who is most distrusted by cats. Are they really conniving? Or is it just miscommunication with humans? I suggest it's our problem more than the cats. And Steve Dale's a certified animal behavior consultant who's authored several books, including the e-book Good Cat, and has contributed to many, including The Cat, Clinical Medicine and Management, edited by Dr. Susan Little. And now a sidebar. What you can do, be a cat ambassador. Be respectful. If someone doesn't like cats, don't force them to be around your cats. On the other hand, if you love cats and someone is negative and unkind about cats, that's a big red flag. Never allow a cat to be abused by a hater. Share the love. Humans fear what they don't understand. Share funny videos, positive stories, and interesting facts about with non-cat people. Don't overshare, as too much can have the opposite effect. Don't become a hater. Support cats and people. Help cats through kind words and actions. And then our photo People who dislike cats may have had a negative experience, such as having extreme cat allergies. This is when their body's immune system reacts to the proteins in the cat's dander, saliva, or urine. Shows a young lady on a couch turning away from her cat and holding her nose as if she is about to sneeze. Okay, with just a very brief amount of time left, we're going to hear about a new breed of dog, the new dog on the block. The Azawakh, and that's spelled A-Z-A-W-A-K-H. The new dog on the block, the Azawakh, a member of the hound group, joins the pack as latest AKC recognized breed. Get to know the latest breed recognized by the American Kennel Club, or the AKC, the Azawakh. This elegant beauty is an ancient breed that originated in West Africa. Although this leggy canine may look delicate, this breed was frequently put to use as a hunting sighthound and was bred to be durable enough for hunting hare, antelope, and even wild boar. These athletic members of the hound group need their exercise, but they aren't all work and no play. Azawakhs are affectionate and keen to bond with their owners. They're cautious, however, and have a tendency to act aloof upon meeting strangers. In terms of exercise, these dogs make for calm indoor companions, but do require a lot of outdoor exercise and play outlets to satiate their need to run and hunt. With a short, fine coat, they only need occasional brushing. The Azawakh was officially recognized by the AKC on January 1st, 2019. So be sure to keep an eye out for this beautiful hound. And now some facts. Origin is West Africa. Weight ranges from 33 to 55 pounds. Energy level is high. Speed is high. Grooming needs, low maintenance and affection. Affectionate with bonded humans. And it has a picture of this dog that is very lean and very sculpted, and I don't know all my dog breeds, but to me it kind of looks sort of like a sort of like a greyhound with these very long graceful legs. So that is the Azawakh, and it looks like with that I am completely out of time. So until next week, when I'm here with a new book, this is Irene Friedman reminding you as always, please spay and neuter your cats and dogs. Thank you very much for tuning in and listening. To everyone out there, have a great day and a great week. Bye, everyone.